Would you like to live in a utopia? The fantasy of a perfect society is one that's tantalized people for millennia. But over the years, quite a few people have attempted to turn that fantasy into reality. Here to tell some of these stories and explain the fascination these ideals hold for us is Kristen Godsey, author of Everyday Utopia, What 2,000 Years of Wild Experiments Can Teach Us About the Good Life. Kristen is an author and a professor of Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, whose work has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the New Republic, among other publications. Here she is.
Hello, my name is Kristen Godsey, and I've spent the last 25 years researching, writing, and teaching about the relationship between the family and society in a wide variety of historical and cultural contexts. I'd like to share five key insights from my new book. The first is that we value blue sky thinking in everything except what matters most. In science, medicine, and the cutthroat world of corporate research and development, our society lauds the advantages of what is sometimes called blue sky thinking. When faced with intractable challenges, leaders will often convene groups of free minds to unleash their imaginations and consider even the most preposterous solutions. The essence of this blue sky thinking is its unboundedness, its audacity, its unabashed willingness to stand accused of naivete and utopianism, its permission to move fast and break things. But when it comes to dealing with difficult social problems, we move slow and preserve things. Although growing inequality is sowing division and eroding democracy, and although people around the world are suffering from the compounding epidemics of loneliness, meaninglessness, and the pervasiveness of existential despair, we play it safe. We don't unleash our creativity to rethink the most basic aspects of our day-to-day experiences. Where we live, who we love, with whom we share our things, or how we raise our children. But if we are to survive and thrive in the 21st century, we need to apply this type of blue sky thinking to our private as well as our public lives. So my second insight is that people have actually been experimenting with alternative ways of organizing their private lives for over 2,500 years. Ever since Pythagoras and his followers left mainland Greece to set up a colony in what is now southern Italy back in the 5th century BC, mathematicians, philosophers, theologians, dreamers, spiritual seekers, visionaries, and revolutionaries have understood that the way we organize our domestic sphere often upholds the prevailing political and economic norms of our societies. In The Republic, the ancient Greek philosopher Plato dedicated much of Book 5 to reimagining the way the male and female leaders and warriors of his perfect city of Kallipolis would live together, share their things, and raise their children to build a more harmonious society. In 530 AD, Saint Benedict of Nursia wrote out a specific set of rules for how groups of monks could live together communally as a way of retreating from the crass concerns of the material world. About 1,000 years later, Sir Thomas More wrote the little book, Utopia, in 1516. Here, he described a more perfect society where collective ownership and the cooperative rearing of children affords the utopians a prosperous, stable, and joyful society where universal literacy reigned and people elected their leaders, an outlandishly radical idea which contributed to his martyrdom at the hands of Henry VIII. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the aristocrat turned revolutionary, Alexandra Kollontai, warned her male colleagues in the world's first worker state that their attempt to reimagine society would fail if they did not also rethink the traditional Russian family. These dreamers, and many more throughout the millennia, have understood that changes in society at large require new and different ways of living together and defining the family. My third insight is that our existing housing stock limits our ability to live happier, more connected, and sustainable lives. Architects have long understood that our homes both reflect and shape our ideas of family relations. The very physical design of the dwellings we inhabit promotes a certain set of social norms about the types of domestic work that should be provided within the individual household. In the standard single-family abode, we are each tasked with cooking and cleaning up in our own kitchens, doing our laundry in our private washing machines that sit unused most of the week, or mowing our little pieces of lawn, even though there are huge economies of scale that could be realized. From an environmental perspective, heating and cooling individual homes is remarkably wasteful in the long run, as is equipping them with large appliances designed to be obsolete in 10 years, which will then pile up in our landfills. Furthermore, the American National Institute on Aging claims that the health risks of prolonged isolation are the same as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and that extended periods of loneliness can shorten a person's lifespan by as much as 15 years. At the same time, we know from recent empirical studies conducted everywhere from Norway to Japan that more communal forms of dwelling can make our lives less lonely, less harried, and less deleterious to the environment. The Danish experience with co-housing and more recent international experiments with co-living try to optimize the balance between our need for privacy and our inherent desire for companionship. So why do we live the way we do? Because we are still stuck with the architecture of the last century. Most of our current housing options reflect a domestic ideal that no longer makes social, psychological, or environmental sense. We are long overdue for a hardware update. The fourth key insight from my book is that our romantic relationships should not be the only container for parenthood. Now, I realize that this might sound a little controversial, but hear me out. If we examine the vast diversity of human family forms across cultures and throughout history, we must accept that at different times and places, humanity has embraced different mating and child-rearing practices, depending on specific geographic, climatic, social, political, and economic circumstances. We know from research in fields like evolutionary anthropology and biology that humans have survived and thrived in many different circumstances by evolving and adapting their family forms to suit a wide variety of conditions, and that there is no one natural way of organizing the smallest unit of our societies. The isolation and loneliness precipitated by COVID-19, as well as the rush to form pandemic pods to help raise and educate our children, reveal the shortcomings of the traditional nuclear family, where two parents raise their kids in a single-family home filled to the rafters with their own stuff. It's important to recognize that our mating practices and our child-rearing practices are separable. We sometimes raise our children exclusively with our romantic partners, but there's no reason that we have to. Many cultures still live multi-generationally, allowing parents and grandparents to share the many responsibilities of parenthood among them. Others live in extended households, which include aunts, uncles, and older siblings and cousins that all contribute to the work of child rearing. Beyond kinship relations, some people decide to become platonic parents, where friends, colleagues, or companions bring children into their lives in the absence of a romantic attachment or consanguine relation. In other cases, romantic couples might legally add a third or fourth co-parent to formalize an important relationship to the child. This can be an egg or sperm donor in the case of same-sex couples, the surrogate mother, or an asexual family friend who wants to experience the joys of parenthood independent of a romantic attachment. Divorced, abandoned, or widowed parents might also choose to expand their definition of family to share their emotional, attentional, and financial resources for the sake of their children. This isn't to say that people won't still have children with the people they feel romantically attached to, but merely to recognize that romantic attachments often fade faster than our responsibilities as parents do. High rates of divorce create instability that is deleterious to children's welfare in the long run. The answer to this problem is not to strengthen marriage or to more effectively trap people in unhealthy or unsatisfying relationships by making it more difficult to divorce, but rather to separate our romances from our roles as parents. We can expand our definition of family to include a wider constellation of relationships. And finally, my fifth insight is very much related to the fourth, and that's to argue that children thrive in environments full of loving adults. It not only takes a village to raise a child, but it's also healthier for children to be raised by multiple caring adults who are invested in their welfare. Human beings were cooperative breeders before biparental care became a social norm in the West. And we have good psychological evidence to show that the cognitive development of babies is faster and more robust when they can form secure attachments to both kin and non-kin caregivers. Now, some U.S. states already allow for children to have three or more legal guardians, and these arrangements will only continue to proliferate in the future. Legally recognizing the rights of more than two parents protects children from being placed in foster care if one or both biological parents leaves, dies, becomes ill, suffers from a mental health issue, or is otherwise incapable of caring for a child. Too many loving grandparents, godparents, step-parents, and others have been deprived of their de facto parental roles by courts which refuse to consider the importance of non-biological parents in the lives of children. Perhaps more important, as increasing numbers of millennials and members of Generation Z decide to forego childbearing in protest against climate change or in protest against the housing crisis or the growing precarity of their financial futures in a brutal gig economy, a growing acceptance of multi-parenting might offer different opportunities for them to share in the joys of parenthood. Rather than struggling to rebalance the division of breadwinning and caregiving between just two people, young people may decide to spread all of the physical, financial, mental, and emotional requirements of raising happy and healthy children out more broadly among a greater number of committed adults. Not only will children benefit from more stability and continuity, but strained parents will feel less isolated and more supported if the demands of caregiving or breadwinning temporarily prove too overwhelming for them. By learning from the many social dreamers who came before us, and with a little creativity and blue sky thinking, we can find new ways to expand our definition of the family to help us live more loving, caring, and connected lives.
Thank you, Kristen. That was 5 big ideas from Everyday Utopia, what 2,000 years of wild experiments can teach us about the good life by Kristen Godsey. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a perfect day.